It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So the pesto didn't work. Have you ever thought that your basil may be out of sorts? This week, we meet a scientist, the University of Missouri's Heidi Apple, who studies whether plants can feel.
Plants are able to sense the same things in their environments that we do, but the systems they use to sense things usually aren't in specialized organs like us. So, for example, you know, we're all familiar with the seedling growing towards the light on our kitchen windowsill, and that's because they can detect light. They can detect odors. They can also detect sound and vibrations, and previous work showed that they can distinguish the vibrations of caterpillar feeding from wind and other noises in their environment and get defenses ready.
I'm not sure how vegans are going to interpret this information, but lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Vegans, you might want to cover your ears. According to Dr. Heidi Apple, a senior research scientist at the University of Missouri, plants, including all the leafy greens and herbs we love, can recognize the sound of a predator. And shockingly, that predator could be you, filling a basket with vegetables from your garden. Correspondent David Leet got the story.
Heidi, welcome to the program.
Thank you, David.
Heidi, you've been doing some very interesting research recently with plants. Your basic tenet, if I'm paraphrasing correctly, is that plants know when they're being attacked and they react. Is that correct?
That's correct. There are a bunch of plant scientists all over the world that have been contributing to this kind of study. And what our work did was show for the first time that they have a very fine-tuned ability to tell insects apart.
Really? And how do they do that?
Well, when plants get wounded, it's very much like when we get wounded. There are wound signals generated at the site of damage, and those signals are transported to other parts of the plant. And plants respond locally by trying to seal up the damage site right away because they can get attacked by pathogens and get infections just like we do when we get cut.
And do they do anything environmentally? Do they send out any signals once that happens to them when they're attacked?
They do. There are changes that happen inside the leaves that you can measure, but there are also things that happen outside the leaves. So the plants are releasing volatiles into the environment, and that's the smell of fresh mown hay or even your yard when you mow it. And those volatiles are detected by two other kinds of things that help out the plants. One is that the enemies of the insects eating the plants use those volatiles as a way to know that there's food on that plant for them. And then you can find that plants that have been undamaged but are nearby, close enough to receive that volatile signal, will get their defenses primed and ready to go as well.
So it's a whole cycle of protection.
Yes. And there's things going on underground. That's not the focus of my research, but others have shown that there's a whole network of communications below ground.
Really?
Between plant roots that are mediated mostly by fungi that form associations with roots of plants.
So is it a stretch to say that plants have feelings?
I think so. I mean, plants have senses, certainly, but feelings involve emotions, which is higher cognitive level processing.
Okay.
And I don't think they do it.
Okay. But there's definitely an action and reaction system that's going on that's highly evolved.
Yeah, as highly evolved as ours. It's just that the systems they use to sense things usually aren't in specialized organs like us. So they can see things, and everyone knows that from watching their seedling grow towards the light on the kitchen windowsill, and that's because they can detect light. They can detect odors, and I just gave you an example of that with odors being released by damaged plants and calling in helpful insects. And then they can also detect sound and vibrations. And previous work I've published with Rex Cockcroft showed that they can distinguish the vibrations of caterpillar feeding from wind and other noises in their environment and get defenses ready to go.
And in that research, from what I read, that if there was a recording of that particular sound or vibration that was played before versus for those plants that did not have that recording, there was a different reaction in those plants, wasn't there?
Yes, there was, because when those plants were subsequently attacked by insects, the ones that had received the feeding vibrations made more defenses.
That's fascinating. Heidi, talk a little bit more about these defenses and how they're used by the plant world and also how they're used by us as people.
Oh, David, I think your listeners will be very familiar with a lot of these plant chemicals because they're the things that we use in herbs and spices and in natural medicines.
Oh.
So, you know, for example, in the plant I work with, the defense is largely mustard oils, and that's the thing that gives mustard its kick.
Interesting. So that's some of the defenses that are kicked out into the environment.
Well, the plants make more of them in their leaves, and then when the caterpillars come to eat them, the levels get high enough, they get turned away from eating the plant. It's kind of like having too much mustard on your hot dog.
So are there any practical agricultural uses for your research?
Well, we hope there are down the line. When plant breeders go to develop pest-resistant plants, it's important for them to know how plants detect that they're being attacked and what they can do about it. So this information helps them in their breeding programs. Also, the ability of plants to detect vibrations of insect feeding and those vibrations transmitted throughout the plant means that we might be able to develop sensors based on these feeding vibrations that can be used in the field to target pesticide use in a more efficient and thus less costly and detrimental way.
Heidi, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've learned so much.
You're very welcome, David. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Heidi Apple is Senior Research Scientist at the Christopher S. Bond Life Sciences Center and Division of Plant Sciences at the University of Missouri. Now, David Leet is the publisher of Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. Find our recipe for summer greens with melon salad. You're going to make this all summer, I promise, at splendidtable.org. I think Chef Rick Bayless and one word comes to mind, Mexico. It's the center of his PBS show, his books, and his restaurants. But what we don't see much of is Rick, the city farmer. Yet he tends a 1,000-square-foot bio-intensive garden. And besides that, in 2003, Rick launched his Frontera Farmer Foundation, supporting small Midwestern farms. So why are we not surprised to see that the heart of his latest book, More Mexican Every Day, is the vegetable? Contributor Noel Carter spoke with Rick about the Mexican way with vegetables.
Rick, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you.
More Mexican Every Day. This is your 9th cookbook, and it's the 10th anniversary since you celebrated Mexican Every Day. What inspired you to compile this cookbook?
Well, when I wrote Mexican Every Day, I was really trying to get to the bold flavors that I'm known for, these traditional Mexican flavors, but done in such a simple way that you could put dinner on the table in about a half an hour. And after 10 years, I reflected on what kinds of things I would do if I was writing that book today. And I recognized that there's just an explosion of vegetables in our markets and in our farmers' markets in particular. And the farmers are growing all kinds of things that we don't necessarily know how to work with as a culture. And you can take a new look at traditional Mexican vegetables and say, so what would I do with them in a sort of modern kitchen without taking the guts out of the flavor? Or looking at unexpected vegetables like asparagus and artichokes, which people don't associate with the Mexican kitchen, and say, how would those be treated in a traditional Mexican kitchen in terms of flavor? And then, of course, there's all the squashes. And in my farmer's market, I don't know about yours, but it just seems like the variety is endless.
And you have this recipe for grilled chayote squash, which you don't normally think of that as being grilled.
Ah, but that's the way to do it. Either grill it or roast it. You know, in the Mexican traditional kitchen, most of the recipes will start by asking you to boil it. But to me, that's like boiling green beans. I'm never really wild about boiled green beans. I'd rather grill them or roast them. And the same is true of chayote. First of all, chayote has a lot of natural water in it. And if you boil it, you're just accentuating that wateriness. If you roast it, you're actually reducing, or grill it, you're actually reducing the water that's in it, and you'll be absolutely blown away about the sweetness that will come out of it if you do the roasting and concentrating of those flavors. And then just put a very simple kind of dressing on it. Now, in the book, I chose to do one of my secret weapons, which is, there's four of them in here, and I will tell you that, honest to goodness, these four things are in my refrigerator all the time because they are the things that help me to get to great flavor fast when I'm cooking at home. And I do cook at home. Even though I'm a restaurant chef, I love to cook at home. But I, like everybody else, I don't really spend a ton of time with it. So I've got four of these secret weapons. There's the most common marinade in Mexico, a red chili garlic marinade. That would be my number one. But then there is a green version of that that's green chilies with herbs, and that's number two. There is one that's made from roasted garlic and olive oil, a touch of chipotle chili, and a little bit of lime and salt. Mojo de ajo, super easy to make. And then the last one is a sweet and tangy, but very spicy, smoky chipotle marinade for those that are heat lovers. But the cool thing about these secret weapons is you can keep them in your refrigerator for a really long time, like several months, and they'll stay beautifully fresh, and you can just pull them out and use them whenever you want. And that green chili herby marinade on roasted chayote is probably one of the best things I have had in a long time.
That's great. You know, people so often think of Mexican food as being heavy and labor-intensive, but you've got so many of these light and refreshing vegetable dishes. The book really shows otherwise.
Yeah. Well, Mexican food, especially what we consider Mexican-American food, whether it's Tex-Mex or New Mex or Arizona, Northern Sonora Desert cooking or California Mexican, all of those have a tendency to rely a lot on a fryer and a lot of melted cheese and sour cream and guacamole. And yeah, it's fun to eat that food every once in a while, but it's not necessarily what people want for simple weeknight stuff. And I think that we are broadening our perspective in the United States, because when my first book came out back in the Paleolithic period, 28 years ago, basically, if I said regional Mexican food, people just didn't even compute that. It was the fact that they knew Mexican food to only be Mexican-American food. They didn't realize that Mexico had a different cuisine, and they didn't realize that within Mexico, there were at least six major regions and then many minor ones beyond that. And nowadays, if I say, oh, I do food like from central and southern Mexico, people just nod their head and say, oh, okay, that's really different than what we get at our local, you know, Mexican-American eatery here. And I'll say, yeah, yeah. So we've understood now that there are different cuisines, and we're beginning to understand that there are different regional cuisines in Mexico. And when you walk into a Mexican market, the first thing that you are taken with is that there are the most amazing displays of vegetables. They're beautiful displays, but they're also enormous displays. And people in the United States do not think about Mexican food as having much of a vegetable component. And yet, when you walk into a Mexican market, you learn otherwise, because they have all those vegetables and they are using them in so many different ways. Now, the traditional ways would be more to put them in stews with bits of meat. Now, it's not a heavy meat cuisine except for special occasions. And then they would do a lot of soups, because Mexico is really rife with all kinds of soups. What I've done is sort of taken them out of just those two contexts and given them a bigger, broader play, just like a lot of the chefs in Mexico City are doing right now, because there's a whole movement of the young chefs of Mexico City doing brilliant work, and they're all falling in love with vegetables treated as special dishes. Forget the meat, they say. Let's just concentrate on the vegetables right now. And I think that's brilliant.
It's just wonderful. Rick, I can't wait to try every single recipe in this new cookbook. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure to talk with you, Noelle. I really appreciate it.
Rick Bayless is author of More Mexican Every Day. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Now, we have a recipe from Rick for a Mexican take on zucchini. find his creamy zucchini, corn, and roasted poblanos at splendidtable.org. Boy, that sounds good. Coming up, what people eat to live to 100, and a look at the past, present, and future of the world's most popular fruit, the banana. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. A number of years ago, National Geographic sent Dan Buettner and a team of scientists out to discover why, in certain parts of the world, people lived a century or more. They weren't just old. They were healthy, engaged, and seemingly content. Dan dubbed the seven areas the Blue Zones and documented the whys and hows of these communities in a couple of books. Well, his latest book is about a major leap. In 2009, he and a team of scientists transferred the Blue Zone principles to American towns. The book is called The Blue Zone Solutions, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. Dan, good to have you back.
I am delighted to be here, man.
You know, for those who maybe five people left in the world who don't know about Blue Zones, could you explain what you're talking about when you say Blue Zone?
So this was a 10-year project with National Geographic that set out to find the pockets in the world where people live demonstrably longer, either the highest rates of centenarian or the highest life expectancy. And we found one in Okinawa, Japan. The longest-lived women in the world live in Okinawa, Japan. The longest-lived men live in villages in Sardinia, an Italian island. We found one in Ikaria, Greece, where people largely elude dementia. In Costa Rica, the Nicoya Peninsula, people are about 2.5 times more likely to reach a healthy old age. And here in America, it's among the Seventh-day Adventists in Loma Linda, California, who live 10 years longer than the rest of us. And the goal of the project was to, in a sense, reverse engineer longevity, find out what they were doing and learn the lessons that we can apply to our lives.
Now, when you say live longer, there was the qualification, living well as they lived longer.
Yeah, the general rule is the longer you've lived, the healthier you've been. So in these places, they're not only living longer lives, the disabled part at the end of their lives are compressed or shortened. The real secret, though, is none of these spry centenarians said at age 50, well, oh, darn it, I'm going to get on a longevity diet and live another 50 years. Mm-hmm. In every case, longevity happened to them. In other words, it ensued as opposed to being pursued. They lived in environments that nudged them into moving more, eating a little bit less, eating a little bit better, living out their purpose, which is really important. And they tended to have really healthy social networks. So it's not one silver bullet, it's silver buckshot.
Ah, okay. All right. You've done a couple of books on this, but tell me about this latest one.
Well, I came to realize that the runway to health is through our mouths. So we took a really deep dive into the diets of longevity around the world. We worked with the University of Minnesota, and we distilled down 155 dietary surveys in all five Blue Zones. So what were 100-year-olds eating for the past 100 years? And then distilled it into easy guidelines, not only what they were eating, but how they were eating as an effort to introduce Americans to the idea of Blue Zones.
Can you give us a nugget?
First of all, they were eating a very high-carb diet. About 65% of what they were eating were carbohydrates, mostly grains, oatmeal for breakfast, for example. The longest-lived women in the world, Okinawans, ate mostly sweet potatoes. And the cornerstone of every longevity diet in the world is beans. About a cup of beans a day. I would argue that's the best longevity supplement in the world. Ounce for ounce more protein than beef at 1/5 the cost.
That's pretty interesting. Okay, but in this book, you did a series of makeovers of entire towns.
So the central idea of Blue Zones is longevity happens to people. You live in the right environment. So based on that, we start with Albert Lea, Minnesota. And we helped the city change their food policy. We worked with almost all the restaurants, the grocery stores to make eating environments just 10 or 20% healthier. Mm-hmm. And we ended up, after working with them for about a year and a half, lowering their healthcare costs by 40%. And now working with a company called Healthways, we're in 23 cities and the whole state of Iowa doing these Blue Zone makeovers.
Part of the Blue Zones, there were things that naturally evolved from people's cultures.
the way they ate, but also a sense of community among them. Close friends for a lifetime, people you saw all the time, and as you said, a sense of purpose. How do you superimpose that on this culture? I mean, we're completely different. We don't have, you know, thousands of years or hundreds of years of those kinds of elements embedded in our entire surroundings and how we live.
So if your three best friends are obese and unhealthy, there's about 150% better chance that you'll be overweight yourself. So what we've been really successful at doing in these cities is cluster people in groups of fives. We take the idea from Okinawa. They're called Moais. And we just have them commit to either walking together or having plant-based potluck dinners together for 10 weeks. And we found in Albert Lea to begin with that about 60% of these Moais stay together. So you then set up this sort of permanent social network that supports healthy eating or movement that tends to last, well, to date, 5 or 6 years. And these have been
It's still successful after 5 or 6 years.
With 60% of the people who sign up for it. Social interaction is very important to humans. If you're technically lonely in this country, it shaves about 8 years off your life expectancy. Mm-hmm. So just the mere act of being socially connected with people who care about you is part of that whole longevity formula.
How about the political side of this? When you're talking about changing an environment in an entire town, there has to be cooperation among the leaders.
Yes. First of all, we only come into cities that invite us. And when we come in, we get a pledge from the mayor, the city manager, the head of public health, the superintendent of schools, and the big CEOs, or mm-hmm. we don't come in. And then we do come in with a bundle of food policies that make eating fruits and vegetables cheaper and more accessible and eating junk food harder. We say that right up front. We want a healthier food environment here. But instead of like Bloomberg and coming in saying, you have to limit the size of your sodas to 16 ounces.
Yeah, the mayor of New York.
That's in our bundle. That's in our menu of food policies. But we show them 40 other evidence-based policies that create a healthier food environment. And then they choose what's right for them.
What percentage of a town population gets involved with these Blue Zone projects?
Well, if you're affecting food policy and active transportation policies and tobacco policies, you impact 100% of the We usually get about 50% of the restaurants, about 20% of the large workplaces. We usually get the big grocery chain involved. And then we get somewhere between 15 and 20% of individuals taking a Blue Zone pledge. So it's critical mass. We see drops in obesity by as much as 15% in some of our cities. And our big win in the Los Angeles beach cities, we dropped smoking rate by 30%, which will save tens of millions of dollars.
That's really amazing. Dan, great work. And thanks for joining us.
I am thrilled to be with you, Lynn.
Dan Buettner is author of The Blue Zone Solution, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. Now, he left us with a recipe for a classic. You can find his spiced lentil recipe at splendidtable.org. It's the classic cereal topper. It hides in cream pie. Athletes love its potassium. 400 million people eat it as a primary food. Some chomp as much as 500 pounds a year. I'm talking about the banana. The fruit that earns $8 billion a year and could have a dicey future. So with all this, what's the banana's story? Commentator Rebecca Shear talked with Nicole Vitello. She's president of Equal Exchange Bananas, a for-profit fair trade worker-owned cooperative headquartered in Massachusetts.
Nicole Vitello, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So here in the U.S., we can easily talk about apples. We have a layman's knowledge of potatoes. Bananas we eat every day, but we don't really know much about them. Why is that?
Yeah, it's interesting, the banana as a product. You know, banana companies were essentially the original multinationals and is still one of the few produce items that can be exclusive to a company. Bananas are such a particular crop that they need a lot of special treatment, special growing practices, special shipping and distribution. But essentially, the history of bananas is not a very happy one. So, you know, I think that there's been an an issue of keeping the consumer sort of separated from the supply chain in bananas. So hence, we sort of had Dancing Bananas, Miss Chiquita, to tell the banana story without really talking about growers or varieties or distribution.
You mentioned an unhappy history. Why so unhappy?
Well, you know, bananas continue to be a very cheap fruit, and yet they're a tropical fruit that's shipped halfway around the world. So, you know, the initial idea around banana distribution was vertical integration. So you control the farms, you control the shipping routes, you control the import and warehousing and distribution. 100 years ago, that was really an unheard of concept. So the banana sort of shows up here ripe and ready every week on your supermarket shelf. You know, we still see it around the country at 39 or 50 cents a pound. You know, it was designed to be that way. It was designed to be the same price or cheaper than an apple or another piece of fruit in order to get it into the hands of the American consumers in volume. You know, an individual banana to get here would be very expensive, but thousands and thousands and thousands per week and container shipping. That's really the game behind bananas.
And I understand another dark side of the banana, if you will, is that it's based on a monoculture. First of all, can you explain what a monoculture is and why that might not necessarily be a good thing?
So the variety of banana that we see here is the Cavendish variety. It's a genetic clone. It's actually a giant herb. It basically propagates only from itself. And so it cannot adapt to you know, heirloom varieties or organic varieties are often adapted to withstand the threats against them from pests, from disease. And in fact, the banana does not do that. It's actually a very weak plant. So it's grown in a monoculture climate in order to control for that weakness by using many chemicals. You know, bananas are sadly the second most chemically intensive crop grown after cotton. And we grow and eat a lot of bananas. Basically, about 50 years ago, the variety of banana that was most common, the Gros Michel or the Big Mike banana, was completely wiped out by Panama disease. And that is because when you grow in a large monocrop, means only one crop is grown in this area, and you try to control artificially for all of the things that in nature would happen, then all of a sudden you have a really weak plant that is open up to threat. So hence the more and more spraying for, you know, fungicides and pesticides and the really noxious environment around banana farms and plantations. Often these plantations are located close to, you know, residential areas, schools, rivers. So the dark history of bananas is basically we've exported a lot of the costs of this fruit in order to have a cheap, happy fruit here for the American consumer who really does not know the true story behind bananas nor really understands the true cost of this product for people in Central and South America.
Is it better to buy organic bananas? Does that make any difference?
Well, it does make a difference. Organic bananas, as well as, you know, fair trade bananas, Rainforest Alliance, there are some protections both for the American consumer, but also I would say with organic bananas, the main thing that you're ensuring is the level of chemical spray and the effect on people in Central and South America is definitely minimized with organic. So organic is an added incentive. I know a lot of people here as American consumers sort of say, well, you know, it's not on the Dirty Dozen list or I'm going to peel it, so maybe it's not as important to buy organically. But I would urge people to consider, you know, the effects that those really noxious chemicals are having on environments far away from us. And then I think even beyond that, you know, Equal Exchange, we do all organic and 100% fair trade bananas. So fair trade ensures that there's a relationship, a direct relationship with the farmer. We pay a minimum price, and a dollar per box of bananas goes back to the farmer co-op that can be invested in their community.
So, Nicole, what does the future hold? How is this crop going to change?
Well, I think it is diversification and also just changing our thoughts around the banana. You know, this very ubiquitous, cheap fruit that we see on the grocery store shelf 365 days of the year may not be the future. Climate change is happening. Global warming is happening. We're seeing a lot of agricultural products affected. And I think we have to start reconsidering the banana as not a ubiquitous, cheap, happy fruit, but as something that is an agricultural product grown by people, often under very difficult and adverse conditions.
Nicole Vitello, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
It was my pleasure.
Nicole Vitello is president of Equal Exchange Bananas. Rebecca Shear is host of Metro Connection on WAMU in Washington, D.C. Find a classic recipe for banana pudding from Chef Bill Smith of Crook's Corner in Chapel Hill at splendidtable.org. It is time for us to connect with you, 800-537-5252. We've got Lindsay calling from Wilmington, North Carolina. You guys have the most beautiful oceanfront land. It's so pretty there.
It is really nice. We've actually just moved back here after a while away, and we're enjoying being at the beach this year.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine. It's just gorgeous. But anyway, did you have a question?
I do. I bought a can of sweetened chestnut puree.
Right.
That I just bought on a whim, and it's been sitting in my pantry ever since. The only thing I've ever used it for is as a weight when I'm pressing tofu upon here. And so I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for what to do with this can of about 2 pounds of chestnut, sweetened chestnut puree.
Well, I have to tell you, it's more a winter food than a summer food because it is very dense. Mm-hmm. And heavy, but it can be utterly delicious. And one of the things that is done with it, it's a classic dessert, and it's the easiest thing in the world. You fold whipped cream into it.
Okay.
And it's you know, it's not really a pretty thing. It's kind of a grayish, beigeish color. But you fold in whipped cream. And then you take a wine glass and you put a scoop of really good vanilla or chocolate ice cream in it. And you put a couple of spoonfuls of that mixture on top. And then you top that with just straight whipped cream. And then you drizzle it. Oh, the other thing you can add is melted chocolate to it. Because okay. Chocolate and chestnut is fabulous. Just fabulous.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Or you can drizzle a hot fudge, a homemade hot fudge sauce over the top. But it's not a bad thing. The other thing that people use it for is they'll do little tart shells, or they'll buy ready-made tart shells. And again, they'll line the tart shells with chocolate, melted chocolate, stick it in the fridge so it gets hard, and then you put the chestnut puree, and then you top it with whipped cream.
So you wouldn't cook that. You would just be...
No, it's already cooked. It's ready to be used. Now, some people like to add cognac to it. Some people like to add marsala or port to it, a bit more vanilla because it often has vanilla in it. So you can play around with it. Taste it first. Make sure it tastes very good and that the aftertaste is not stale. Because okay. If that's the case, then just toss the whole thing.
And if I don't use it all at once, could I freeze the excess?
Yeah, you could. It's going to break down a bit, but when you take it out of the freezer and you defrost it, you'll just mix it up and it'll come together again. Okay?
Great.
Thanks, Lindsay. Take care.
Bye.
Coming up, more of your questions and a lesson in making authentic Thai curries. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're talking with you this hour. Get to us any way you can. Try Facebook, Twitter, email, go to splendidtable.org. And of course, you can call 800-537-5252. Meredith is on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina. Meredith, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. So my daughter's name is Amelia, spelled with an E, like the region in Italy.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So for her first birthday, I would like to do an Italian dinner with foods from that region.
Right.
And I was just wondering if there's anything that's traditionally served around a birthday in Emilia-Romagna.
Well, there are things that are very celebratory. And one of them is tortellini in broth and handmade tortellini in broth. Now, as a new mom, I don't know if you want to go through making handmade tortellini.
they're pretty labor intensive. You can freeze them, you know, make them ahead. But that may not be what you want to be doing in a situation like this. One other thing is that in some areas, when a child is born, if it's a girl, it's celebrated with lasagna.
Okay.
So a lasagna. Now, lasagna in that part of the world is usually a green noodle, a spinach noodle. And, you know, the pasta there is incredible. It's hand-rolled. It's very thin. It's done with egg and flour. And you can use commercial lasagna pasta. But you do a bechamel sauce and you do a meat sauce without too much tomato in it. And Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese. And so you just do a layer of the bechamel and then a generous sprinkling of Parmigiano and then the pasta and then a layer of the ragu, you know, the meat sauce and the Parmigiano, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you end with the bechamel. You know, that's a white sauce. You're probably familiar with it. So that's one way to go. Another thing that you could do that is extremely simple is a roast chicken with roasted potatoes that are done with pancetta. Because you could do chunks of pancetta with, you parboil, you know, the red skin potatoes, the waxy kind of potatoes. And then what you do is you toss them with olive oil, coarse salt, and chunks of the pancetta. And you roast them in the oven at about 350 to 400. And you want them to roast slowly, and you're basting them with any fat in the pan until they actually get so crusty that they crunch. And you can reheat those potatoes. And then you do a roasted chicken that you've rubbed with rosemary and garlic, olive oil, and you can serve that with the potatoes and then a green salad of really tart greens like escarole and curly endive or frisée and arugula because that bite with the richness of the chicken and the richness of the potatoes. And that's often a main course. But there's always a pasta. A simple pasta, just butter and cheese, garlic and olive oil, but there's always a starter of a pasta. But that's old-time celebration food. Is that the sort of thing you're looking for?
Yeah, that sounds great. Is there any kind of, you know, dessert or kind of sweet treat that's traditional?
Well, there's a lot of them, but there's one, and it's the simplest thing in the world. I don't know that you would associate solely with birthdays. You know, every area of every region in Italy has its specialties. And in the Modena area, there is a cake called benzone. It's also referred to as crumbling cake. And you know, I wrote a book about this region, and the recipe is in the book, The Splendid Table. I don't know if we have it on the website. It's basically a biscuit recipe with double or triple the amount of butter that a standard biscuit recipe would have. And about for every 2 cups of flour, I would say there's about a third of a cup of sugar. And there's grated lemon rind in it. So it would be the rind of half a lemon. So if the recipe says 2 cups of flour, you add, instead of a couple of tablespoons of butter, you would probably add almost a whole stick. You would add that third of a cup of sugar, and you would add the grated zest of half of a large lemon. And then you put it together as a tube, almost, that has a slight S shape. And the thing that you do with it is you can make a groove in the top of it and you put good chunky jam in that. And then you bake it off. And it's eaten with sweet white wine. So it could be Vin Santo. It could be Muscat de Baume de Venise, because the sweet wine of that area, if you can get it, a sweet Lambrusco is what you would eat it with. And the idea is it crumbles up and you dip it in the little small glass of the sweet wine. And some of the crumbs end up in the wine and some of the crumbs end up in your mouth. It's just delicious. It's wonderful.
That sounds great.
It really is. It really is. It's a very, very traditional recipe. And it's great fun at the end of a fairly rich dinner. You know, it's not heavy. And it people just keep nibbling at it. They sit there and they nibble and nibble. And you would have fresh fruit, maybe some strawberries, that kind of cut up oranges, that sort of thing, which are always served at the very end of the meal with coffee and liqueurs, of course.
So, of course.
So that's the basic idea. And I think your one-year-old, well, she may not get a kick out of it, but everybody else is going to.
Oh, that sounds perfect. Thank you.
You are welcome.
Bye.
Bye. Gabrielle's calling from, or Gabrielle, excuse me, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Gabrielle?
Yes.
What do you want to talk about, madam?
Crawfish stock.
Oh, my. Where did you get crawfish stock?
I made it.
Oh, where did you get the crawfish? That's so luxurious.
Far away. Well, so my family and I are Louisiana transplants living in Iowa. And so the last few years, with the advent of being able to buy anything you want online,
right,
we started having crawfish shipped up to kind of connect with our roots.
Right.
And so we've been having these crawfish boils, and this year I made a bunch of stock with the leftover shells. And all I can think of to do with it is gumbo, but we have a lot of stock, and I just wanted some other ideas of what to do with it.
Do you like Vietnamese food?
Yes.
How about doing sort of a you know, the famous Vietnamese soup? It's called pho. It's spelled P-H-O.
Yes.
How about doing sort of a crawfish version of that?
That's a good idea.
So you've already got the stock, so you're almost home free. What you want to do is take, you probably want about 2 quarts of the stock. You want to slice up a couple of onions, spread them on a piece of foil. You may put a little bit of a neutral oil on them, like canola, just something to just slightly moisten them. A couple of broken star anise. Can you get that?
Probably.
Yeah. Okay. A couple of cinnamon sticks. About a tablespoon of coarsely ground black pepper.
Mm-hmm.
And some, smashed whole cloves of garlic, but they're in the skin.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And you're going to put that under the broiler. And you're going to toast that. And you're going to get the onions picking up a bit of color. Don't burn the spices. As the spices become aromatic, just kind of scrape them off into a bowl. Then all of that goes into your 1.5 to 2 quarts of the stock with a bit of cut up ginger, perhaps a tablespoon or so of slices. And you're going to simmer it for about a half hour. Strain it. And now what you do is you boil up, or you take rice noodles. And the way you cook rice noodles is you just reconstitute them. So you can put them in a pot of very hot water and you stir them. And as they start to come apart, give it about 5 minutes. And then I want them to have a little chew left, but I don't want them to be crunchy. At that point, you drain them, rinse them with cold water. Divide that between, let's say, 4 bowls. Put the noodles in. You can do thin sliced beef. You can do more crawfish. You can add thin slices of shrimp. Classically, it's done with beef. But you can put almost anything in it, cooked or uncooked. And then have on the side lettuce leaves, sprigs of coriander and mint, things like thin sliced chilies, bean sprouts if you've got them, and any greens you want to put in.
Okay.
Okay? Pour the boiling broth over those noodles. And pile all those other vegetables and condiments onto a platter, put them in the center of the table, and have a bottle of fish sauce. And that's it. And everybody puts into the soup whatever they want.
Okay.
You know, by the way, this recipe is on the website. And I think it's called a – what is it? My producer's talking in my ear. It's Cheater's Pho.
Okay.
Okay? And it's really easy, but with crawfish stock – God, it's going to be unbelievably good.
Good. All right. Thank you.
You take care and, boy, enjoy that.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Remember, you can call us anytime, 800-537-5252. When you're hungry for something different, you can play fast and loose with a jar of Thai curry paste from the store. But for real deliciousness, to taste true Thai and have the fun of messing around with exciting ingredients, go for the real thing, your own homemade curry paste. Let me tell you, a curry paste in the freezer is like money in the bank. Now, the teacher you want is Thai chef Nong Dax. Her restaurant, Thai Basil, is in Chantilly, Virginia. Her first book is Nong's Thai Kitchen, 94 classic recipes that are quick, healthy, and delicious. Nong, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, Nong, when did you first start making curries?
When I was 7 years old, my parents are kind of separate, you know, go 2 different ways. And my father left me with my sister-in-law, who was a caterer in southern part of Thailand. And in that part of Thailand, you know, we always eat curries, like 3 meals a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
So you were the one making the curries at 7 years old?
Yes.
That's a complicated thing to do.
My friend called me Cinderella because I have to do something to help them. And her profession was, you know, a caterer. So she would put ingredients on a little tray, you know, like a pinch of this, a pinch of that. And she said, no, you must remember because tomorrow you have to do this again and again. So I have to count how many peppers in there and how many garlic cloves and shallots and so on, you know. So that's how we start.
Well, what I'd love for you to do is to start us, because I think, you know, most people use the curry paste that you can buy in the store.
Yes.
And when they look at a recipe for Thai curry and they see the long list of ingredients, they're totally intimidated. So can you walk us through how you do a curry paste? And then we can talk about actually making the curry.
Yeah. First, you have to choose what kind of curry you're going to make, because we have red curry, green curry, yellow curry, sour curry, and so on. Then you have to choose the meat to go in there. Could be chicken, pork, or beef, or lamb, or goat, you know, in the South. We don't really have lamb, but we use goat. But the first one should be the one that have least ingredients. For example, in my cookbook, the gang kai gole, that is the easiest and I think one of the best. It has only 8 ingredients altogether, including chicken. So you have a blender, and then you start with chili peppers. This one use the dry, long chili pepper, the red one. You soak that in the water for 20 minutes so it, you know, nice and soft, and just throw it in there. And then, you know, follow with some garlic and shallot and coriander seed that already dry fry in the pan, and a half of the amount of cumin.
So whatever amount of coriander seed you have, you'd use half that amount of the cumin seed. Okay.
You know, like 2 teaspoons of coriander seed, so it would be 1 teaspoon of cumin seed. And then some turmeric powder or fresh turmeric, which nowadays in Asian grocery store, you know, it's not hard to find.
Right.
And like some cinnamon and then salt and shrimp paste. Put a little bit of water in and you just blend it and that's all.
That's your curry paste.
Yeah, that's done.
And how do we cook the curry paste?
Well, you put a little oil in the pot that you want to cook the curry in, and then you quick stir fry the curry paste until it, you know, smell fragrant, maybe 2-3 minutes, and then you add the coconut milk in there, and then let it boil again, and then put, you know, big chicken piece, you know, like chicken thigh. You can also, you know, use it with fish or some other meat, but I think it meant to be, you know, with chicken. And then cover it and let it cook, you know, about 40 minutes or
until the chicken
is tender, yes. But this same curry paste, after you put the coconut milk in, it becomes very thick because there is no other liquid in it. You can soak the chicken in and then grill it.
Ah, so you use it as a marinade.
Yes, a marinade for grilled chicken.
So now can you talk to us about a more complicated curry?
Yeah. Matsaman curry or Penang curry. Those two are also from the southern part of Thailand. The Matsaman curry is the most complicated, and it has cinnamon, cloves, mace, and nutmeg together with, of course, you know, lemongrass and galangal and shrimp paste and salt. All of the ingredients have to be dry fried on a pan so all of the flavor come out. And then you blend it just the same way you blend, you know, other curries, and then cook in a little oil until the rawness is gone, until it's, you know, it smells fragrant. And then you add, typically, you know, we make with beef. So it needs to be cooked, you know, longer time. But there is potato in there, and the flavoring that we use is equal amount of fish sauce, tamarind juice, and palm sugars. This is my mother recipe.
Ah, so fish sauce, palm sugar, and
tamarind juice, liquid.
Tamarind liquid.
Yeah, you buy the paste and you put the proportion that I use is 1/3 of tamarind paste to 3/3 of water. you soak it, you know, just leave it there, forget about it. Yeah. But if you are in a hurry, then you soak in hot water and you kind of smash it and then drain it to remove the pulp from the liquid. And you use that liquid for flavoring the curries and sweet and sour things. We use a lot of those in place of vinegar.
I understand.
And if you don't have palm sugar, you can use light brown sugar.
Uh-huh. And if we can't get the dry Thai chilies, the red Thai chilies, is there any other kind of chili we can use?
Yes, there's Mexican peppers that shape and length and everything look just like the Thai pepper. It's called puya, P-U-Y-A. But it's very funny because the word puya, it means grandfather.
Oh, in Thai.
Yeah. Bu means paternal grandfather, and ya is maternal grandmother.
Oh, for goodness sake.
So, grandparents' peppers.
Yes, exactly. Nong, thank you.
You're welcome.
Chef Nan Dax is author of Nong's Thai Kitchen. She teaches Thai and Vietnamese cooking in Chantilly, Virginia, and you can find her recipe for Penang beef curry at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show this week. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you here next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this Thai saying. The body becomes what the foods are, as the spirit becomes what the thoughts are. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Consider splendidtable.org as your go-to source for great recipes, weekly e-newsletters, download our podcasts, and find information about anything you've heard here. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Now, we'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.